Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in this week to Shop Talk Show. We have two sponsors this week, Environments for Humans. Me and Dave are fresh back from Hawaii. There's still sand in our toes from a fantastic In Control conference in Hawaii, but we'll tell you about, they're going to do In Control again in Orlando, Florida. You can go to 2013.incontrolconference to find out about that. We'll tell you more about it later because it's going to be awesome. And our other awesome sponsor, Majingo, M-I-J-I-N-G-O.com. Majingo has screencasts, kind of intermediate level screencasts, teaching you all about fancy web technologies, stuff that you probably won't find anywhere else. We'll tell you a little bit more about that later in the show as well. But for now, let's kick things off with our thing.
Hello, or as we say in Hawaii, aloha. I'm Dave Rupert, and you're listening to the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front-end web design, development, web stuff. We're just talking shop, and with me is, as usual, is Christopher Coyer. Christopher.
Hi, folks. I really did buy a ukulele in Hawaii. No, yeah, just so we could, like, greet people, and, like, I could play Hawaii and bring them a Mai Tai and stuff. It was fun.
It was good. So many memories. Thanks to anyone who came out. We had a lot of fun. Yes, people from all over the world showed up. That was what, like, blew my mind. People from Australia, Japan. It's crazy.
Took all kinds. It was good. And there'll be more of that in the future. But with us this week, we have a professional podcaster. Both me and Dave has been on his show, The East Wing, separately. Kind of just a really good podcast, Tim Smith. Thanks for
having
us today. Yes.
I'm super excited to be here. And I think the rest of the world is also wondering where the pictures of you guys and the coconut bras are.
It's just, you know, there's one of me in a coconut bra, but as I was trying it on in my room on my Instagram, and it was so small. We would have had to get shoelaces. They wouldn't have even have covered. My nipples are so far apart that they wouldn't even, like, it wouldn't even stretched out as far as you get it. I could cover one nipple at most, and it would be lopsided. Anyway, I just didn't want to put Dave through that.
That sounds awkward, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would have needed, like, a coconut suit of armor, I think, to accomplish the goal. But, what fun we had. Was good. Hey, Timothy, you're Timothy B. Smith on Twitter. What's B stand for? Bronco?
That'd be so cool, actually. No, the B stands for Benjamin.
Oh, there you go. Yep. Awesome. So tell us a little bit about what you do. You've got your own design company called Make Awesome. Is that right? Or no, that was the Kickstarter. I'm messing this up. Somebody help me. Bail me out, Chris.
Well, it's mostly freelancing right now, right? Or do I have it wrong?
So right now I do the East Wing. I'm the host of the East Wing. And I part-time freelance, but I'm part-time director of design at a company called Rocket Lift, which is a WordPress company.
Cool. Previously you were at a Drupal company, is that right?
That is correct, yes.
Drama. So not but just about, like, what's a better CMS?
I don't know if I want to start that.
That's impossible to talk about anyway, isn't it?
But I mean, the content management system that I know is WordPress, so naturally I feel a little bit more comfortable with it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, me too.
Awesome. That sounds good. Good.
So doing lots of stuff, podcasting, freelancing, designing, the director of design. That's fantastic. So a web designer with the best of us here. And so Yeah, what do you got?
I was going to say, the East Wing, if for those who haven't listened to it, is a really, really, really good, well-done podcast. So good job, Tim. But I guess, how did you get into podcasting? What was your kind of, why would you do it? You have a beautiful radio voice.
thank you. I did the podcast because in college I did like a radio and TV major. And I always liked being in front of the microphone, but I sucked so bad at it. So
I can relate. Go ahead.
So then I got into design and I kind of left radio in the background. But it's still something that I really like to do. And I really wanted to have these conversations with these awesome people. And I thought in my head, I was like, you know, I don't think they would agree to having an hour conversation with me unless I was going to post it as a podcast. So that's pretty much why I created the podcast, so that I could have an excuse
to talk
to these people.
Yeah. I love that. You're like, I basically just want to talk to you for an hour, but you'll probably say no to that. Like I can relate to that, because sometimes I get an email like that and I'm like, I would love to talk to everybody, but like, I just, you know, that can't be my whole job. I would never get anything done. But it's like, if you're going to record it and put it online, then there's some like benefit for both of us there. And I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been a real privilege. I mean, I think last week we published, episode 35, and we started in February, and like our listenership is amazing. We have some really loyal people, so it's been great. I love it.
Yeah, everybody listens to this should listen to the East Wing too. It's really good. It's inspiring to me too, because right from the get go, you had like some incredible guests on there, and I was like, I just like inspired by your like ability to just appeal to people's desire to be on podcasts or whatever. Because sometimes I like think of guests and I'm like, oh, they're just gonna say no. Why would they be on our little podcast? But it's like, but you know, just ask, right? And they'll probably say yes, or there's a decent chance of it. And if they say no, what? Who cares? Big deal, right?
Yeah, I mean, you had Zeldman like just a week ago or 2 weeks ago. That's awesome. I want to have him on the show. But I've seen that most people within our industry are super nice. And you email them and you say, hey, do you want to be on my little podcast? It's going to take like 45 minutes of your time. And they're like, sure, I'll do it. When do you want to do it? So it's been nice because, when I first started out, I mean, nobody knew what the East Wing was. I think our first show got like 100 people listening, which is a lot for a first show, but I mean, it's not that much. So it was really nice that everybody was like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. I'll help you out.
That's awesome. Okay. Everybody listen to that. You won't regret it. Good stuff. Get some kind of into the, it's interviewee. It's back into the get into the depths of people in this industry's minds. We have a couple of links to mention just cause I feel like there's some interesting stuff and follow up to mention this week. There is a guy named Brian Fran, brianfran.co. And he emailed me. He's like, hey, I wrote a book about this stuff. Before he launched it, and it was an illustrated guide to front end development. And there's like, so if you go to brianfran.co/wrote-a-book, all one thing squished together, it's like this illustrated book that he wrote about making websites and stuff. And every page of it is like heavily illustrated. It's so good. And I was like, this deserves more attention, because I think it was like super well done. And there's a little video on that page explaining it. And the video is like funny and illustrated and stuff. And the book is like $5. I just think it's awesome. And Brian did a good job, and I'll put the link in the show notes, because I think it's pretty sweet.
So his last name is Franco. He's correcting us in the chat.
Oh, crap.
I know, we blew it.
I'm sorry.
The URL is brianfran.co. So he's creative. He nailed it. His name is ATLD.
The URL is awesome.
Yeah. There you go. Brian Franco.
I'm the worst. Anyway.
That was good.
Cool. And so last week we are, I think, in the last Q&A, I think somebody sent in a question that was, why does Prototype still exist? And it was kind of this funny thing about this, like, outdated-ish, well, it's outdated, straight up, DOM manipulation library for JavaScript Prototype. And they're like, why isn't this thing just shut down kind of thing? Because there's recently an update for it, and it felt kind of weird. And I hope we didn't make anybody mad about that. But there's Sam Stevenson, who I've met, who works for 37 Signals, was the original author of Prototype, published a blog post, and it didn't like mention our show or anything like that. But it was you know, strangely timed just after the show. That was basically about how your software doesn't define you, and about kind of his journey of Prototype and why, you know, he wrote it, and it became out of date fairly quickly, and like it doesn't, and like kind of at one time he kind of took it personally that it was that it kind of went that route, but like in retrospect it's it was still a good idea for him to create it and stuff. It's a very good article and it's on his blog. I'll put a link in the show notes, but yeah, I don't know. I hope we didn't like make him feel sad about that. I'm sure he doesn't listen to this.
I'm pretty sure that article was a direct response to this. Absolutely. We're shaking things up.
If it doesn't, at least, you know, at least it was interestingly timed.
So there you go. From the man himself there. So,
yeah.
The last thing, this was kind of cruising around, but a new thing that you can do for your websites to make them even more responsive URLs. These are pretty awesome. Not.
You'll see the link. So it's like if you're on a desktop browser, you know, the URL bar is like really wide and long, and it can, you can fit a lot of characters of a URL in there. But on a phone, you can't see as many characters. So the idea is to squish your URL smaller depending on how much screen space you have.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. No. I if somebody does this, I will be surprised if their site works. But pretty cool. Pretty funny troll. Troll, roll, roll, roll. Good job, Chris Rowe. That was Chris Rowe doing funny. That.
I didn't even know that's technologically possible.
Yeah, so you, with like push state and HTML and stuff, you can like change the URL. You can. I've seen people do stuff like make animations and stuff in the URL bar and or the title attribute. They'll animate that and stuff.
Oh,
you can kind of do a lot there.
Yeah. It's, I feel like that's a, you know, it's underknown by people, this the history.pushState and history.replaceState, how you can change. It used to be back in the day like a holy rule of web design that if the URL changes, the page refreshes. End of story. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, no matter how you do it, you could have, there was an HTML tag that would redirect the page. There's, you could do it in PHP by sending a header. You could change it in JavaScript through, like, there's like 60 ways to change the URL in JavaScript or something crazy. All of them would refresh the page. And now in HTML5 with history replace state and push state, you can change the URL without a page refresh, which is, for a while, you could change it with the hash link in it, which is why that got popular. There would be a hashtag in the URL and you'd be like, oh, an Ajax site, I see, fancy. But that was a weird tweener time, and that's not as popular anymore, just because, you know, of issues with how Google crawls a site like that.
Right. Okay.
So hash, when you see that, that's a weird tweener legacy thing that they should get out of. And Twitter held on for a little long on it, but they are over it now, which is good. Good for Twitter. Okay. What else do we have?
I think that's it. I think we got everything off the docket and we're ready to.
Let's do the drama question first.
Oh, yeah. We got a little bit of drama. This one from Zachary Kane. Is that right? Here we
yep.
go.
Yep.
So Zachary wrote in and sent us an audio question, our favorite kind of question here at the Shop Talk Show.
Hi, guys. Love the show. Here's a hot drama question for you. I was wondering if you guys happened to catch the latest Web Ahead podcast on 5x5 with guest Andy Clark. He and Jen Simmons discussed speaking on the conference circuit and backlash Andy's experienced through personal versus professional criticism on Twitter and how the community can sometimes be discouraging in the face of quote-unquote celebrity. Do you have any thoughts on the whole kerfuffle?
Whoa, some hot drama.
Which is extra good because we have Tim from the East Wing podcast, and we're talking about another podcast, The Web Ahead. So it's like a triple podcast drama thing. How could we say no to that?
So some drama, the drama is centered around like speaking on the conference circuit. Chris, do you want to kind of break it down what happened? Tim, did you hear this episode? Are you up to speed?
I still have it in my queue. I haven't listened to the whole thing yet.
I'm in the same boat, but I caught a little bit of the beginning of this. And so,
yeah.
Chris, do you want
to summarize it? Sure. I did listen to it just because I listened to that show and I took a drive yesterday after I got this question to listen to, because that's the best time for me to listen to podcasts. I have to like do something where I can't do anything but listen. Anyway. Andy Clark was on the 5x5 Web Ahead with Jen Simmons, and he was being very diplomatic about it, but it was in response to Jeremy Keith's conference in the UK or wherever it's going to be, right? It's in England somewhere, called A Responsive Day Out. And he asked all his friends to come and speak at it, kind of. And, you know, there was a lot, and Andy had this like bevy of tweets that he saved of people like just being dicks about it, essentially, about being like, oh, just a bunch of old faces having another conference kind of thing. And there was some pretty scathing ones that he had in there. And it was just like, oh my God. People are being so rude about this. And Andy, you know, I think in part of like trying to protect his friend, and partially because like he's been a part of this conference scene for so long that this is just like the straw that broke the camel's back for him, was just like, shut up, you know? Like, I can't, like, if you have some problem with the speakers there, like, maybe, I don't know, just don't come to it or, you know, but people are easily take to the Twitter and just post this snarky stuff about, you know, old dogs and web design and how, you know, hey, nice, just no new faces at this conference again, kind of garbage like that. And Andy was just kind of like, you know, just chill out, people, you know, even these people that you see often at these conferences they're not professional speakers. They pour their heart and soul into this. They work really hard. There's an enormous personal tax and time investment to do this type of thing. And they're rewarded with, you know, for the most part, it's totally worth it. And it's all fun and positive, but are rewarded occasionally with snarky crap that they don't deserve. So he was just trying to be protective about that, I think. But the larger drama here, and then I'll shut up, is kind of about, what do we think about the old guard or whatever? Like when you see somebody's
celebrities,
name,
if you will,
yeah, if there is such a thing, which I guess there is. You know, I'm sure people look at conferences, see the same names over and over and over. Is that okay, or should we, or is that not even true, or what's the deal?
Tim, what do you think? Do we have a problem with these stale faces or these celebrities?
Man. You guys are dragging me into drama. I will say this. Of this lineup, I've met Sarah Parmenter, and I think she is an amazing person, and really super nice in person. And I think that could be said for most people who speak, because they're professionals, and they do it day in and day out, and that's the reason why they're chosen to speak, because they have something they have something of value to contribute to a conference. However, I do think that there is a problem with the same faces appearing in every conference. But I don't think that's the problem of the speaker. I think that's the problem of the organizer. And I've seen that conferences like, for example, Circles or ValioCon are making an explicit effort for trying to invite new people, and seeing who's doing something awesome today, and let's talk to them, let's have them speak, and I think that those are efforts worth admiring, because. Yeah, I mean, these people, they provide something of value. There's no doubt about that. But it is nice to see fresh faces and new people who are also doing great things and have a passion for what they're doing within our industry, and that could share something of value.
absolutely. That's good. I would say that, you know, like you're just kind of saying, fresh faces are a good idea. I think we can all agree on that, though, right? Like, deserve the chance to go up and speak. I feel like almost every single conference I go to, the vast, vast majority does that. There are some old guard people there or whatever. We haven't yet had a good, what are we calling them? Web celebrities.
Get it? Celebrities. But hold on. The sound was way too slow for this. Here we go. That was a good one. Say that one more time. One more time.
Celebrities?
God, soundboard. All right. We'll get there.
There's some there, and I think an art conference organizer would say, well, they, you know what, that's who people want to see. That's who's going to sell tickets. This is a business for us. This isn't, you know, like we're trying to help the world a little bit too, but I'm not willing to take a loss for some pie in the sky ideal. We want to sell some tickets, so we need some people that people are going to buy tickets to see, and I'm going to do the best I can in getting some new people in there. That's the vast majority of conferences. Every time I go to one, there's people there that I've never met, that I've never heard of before. Every time. I mean, there might be a few that you could point to that don't do that, but I'm not going to call out anybody or anything, but that is what conferences are. So to have all this drama about it and be like, I don't know what you're talking about, because all the ones I go to, which was a ton this year, for the record, there was new people at all of them, so whatever. Oh, Andy, I'm sorry you got mad. I feel your pain though. Like snarky tweets bug me too. And what can you do? Thick skin.
Yeah. I agree with that. Like, I think, you know, if you want to debate something, that's fine. I don't think there's any reason to ever be disrespectful or rude.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a great way to put it. Just, there's never an excuse for just straight up rudeness. It's just shut up. If you don't, you know, like just do the classic, you know, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And you know, that means you don't have to be this just constantly positive, you know, like censor yourself, but rudeness is useful to nobody.
Yeah.
Thanks for the question, Zachary. We got another one, a little nerdier. Let's get off the hot drama for a minute, although every question in web development has an element of drama to it, of course.
Sure.
This one's from Duncan Smith, and it's about browsers.
Hey, guys. My name's Duncan Smith, and I'm a front-end developer designer. My question is, do you guys think that browsers should support pre-processed CSS syntaxes such as SCSS, SAS, and LESS? Why or why not?
Okay, so should browsers support CSS preprocessor syntaxes?
So, and you know, like you could literally author your SCSS file and not even preprocess it. It would just go out, and the browser would just know what you're talking about and process that as CSS. Should that be a thing?
I think I'm going to go on record and say they shouldn't.
I'm going to say no too. I can see the appeal, right? Like this is pushing the web forward. So why don't browsers just get on board with it? And it's just, I think it's a more complex subject than that. For one thing, what goes into actual CSS goes through a more comprehensive process of discussion and what's good for the web and legacy discussion and standards bodies and yada, yada, yada. The whole, like, it's, things are well vetted by the time they make it into CSS for the most part. Whereas preprocessors have a whole, what makes them awesome is they have this whole different flow. It's one person or a very small team of people just kind of doing whatever they think is best, you know, and just moving quickly and, you know, and not being burdened by that standards body. But they both have different places in the world of web.
I would say no too. And I say no for two reasons. First of all, I think if browsers have a difficulty implementing things right now, imagine having to implement the different syntaxes of a preprocessor.
It's gonna make your job five times harder.
Exactly. And number two, I think the beauty of a preprocessor is that it's so modular and that it, you know, compresses down to one CSS file. That, I love that. That's great.
Pre-processing is the point, right? So if you just, if you could write in the syntax and then ship it out, it's like you're losing the point of preprocessing, of squishing it down into the single files and all that stuff. It's just not the future. And this isn't to say that the browsers, that actual CSS shouldn't take cues from what these preprocessors are doing. And certainly they are. I'm sure that we're getting variables sooner than we would have if preprocessors didn't exist, because the people, the standards bodies, can look at preprocessors and see the vast popularity of them and the features that are being used by them and get it going. So they affect each other, but no, we shouldn't just say, like Chrome shouldn't understand what an SCSS file is, certainly. Cool. We're all in agreement on that. That's good.
Yeah, I think I keep coming back to the core of the web is just these three building blocks, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and I don't care how you make those. You could be using whatever, armpit JS to compile your HTML or something. I don't care. But let's just stick to those, because then those standards bodies can stay standards bodies and we don't need to invent new standards bodies and stuff like that. That's where I come at it from.
Duncan, thanks for the question. I think you can kind of see where we're coming from there. If you have any follow-up, please let us know. But it does, I'm sure you understand. It's not meant to be that way. I doubt people that, is he in the, that's funny. There's somebody who's named not Duncan Smith.
But I do think, I totally get it. It would be awesome if I didn't have to use a compiler. That would be cool. But at the same time, the compiler is just making robo CSS. And so I think that's going to put a lot of overhead on the browser. Things will run slower, stuff like that. So
I almost think if there should be CSS is human readable, mm-hmm. it'd be almost kind of cool if the preprocessor syntax could render down into something that's just absolutely unhuman readable, just like bits and bytes and crap. And that's what the browser would digest and turn into CSS. So it would be even smaller to process, some kind of sub CSS syntax.
Yeah. Kind of like assembly syntax or something.
I think that would make it so much more difficult, though, for beginners to understand how exactly that works, though.
Right. And that's the beauty of CSS, is that that's why it became so popular and so good and so big and so well adopted, is because of just what you said there, is that it's not intimidating. It's so simple. It's declarative language. It's like H1 color red. Nobody doesn't get that,
Yep.
And I'm just throwing that out the window for my machine code idea, but it's just an idea. All right, let's do a sponsor. We have this week Mijingo, Mijingo.com. Lots of good stuff in there. Dave Rupert has a brand new blog. Well, it's not brand new anymore. It's like a month old right now, right?
Monthish oldish.
Yeah, it's built on Jekyll, what do you call them? Client-side site generator? Static site generator?
Static site generator. So you put in your dynamic codes, and it spits out a static site, just a folder full of HTML, CSS,
and JavaScript.
Which is
rad, because when Dave puts that on his site, then there's no database to hit. That means more security, more speed, because all this stuff happens locally, which is where you should be developing anyway, of course, right? It's just a smart idea these days. It's beautiful. Does that sound good to you? Do you want to learn how to use Jekyll? It's not that hard, but it would help to have your hand held through it a little bit, wouldn't it? I know it would be for me. You can go get a video to learn how to use Jekyll from Mijingo.com. Mijingo, you also write your blog posts in Markdown, so you can kind of keep, you don't have to hand author HTML and everything. That's essentially what you do. You have this blog post. It's just a new Markdown file, and that gets all compiled. You want to learn how to use Markdown? Great. There's a video for it on Mijingo. They have all of these good videos and stuff like that. If you put both of those into your cart and use the coupon code HOTDRAMA, it'll knock some bucks off. You can get both of those videos together, really good, long, comprehensive, intermediate-level videos for $15 from Mijingo. You just self serve the ones you want from Mijingo, which I love. So check them out. It's from Ryan Ireland, happy cog dude, super
smart
nice
guy. I was going to say, not to like, so you might be looking at my blog and be like, well, Dave's written one post on Jekyll, and you're absolutely right. But the other day I was on a plane flight, like from Hawaii, right? And maybe it was just like a 2-hour flight, and I like wrote 4 blog posts, and I'm just doing it in Markdown. I'm hitting save, it's compiling, and now it's a website locally. And like, I have like 4 more blog posts to like push out immediately once I like go and tweak them. You don't have to click preview or anything like that. It's just showing up in the browser. It's pretty awesome. So I'm still enjoying the benefits, although posts aren't flopping out of my computer that fast. So there you go. Shall we move on to the next question? Does that sound good, fellas?
Sure does.
Here we go. This one is from Don Ricardo Jr., and it's an audio question.
Hey, guys. Don Ricardo Jr. here at DRicardoDesigns on Twitter. According to SitePoint.com, websites got fat. The average page weight has increased 30% in 2012. It's up to about 1.25 megabytes on average. What is your opinion about this? I know we should be designing for content and with the future in mind. Does that mean we developers should not utilize frameworks and libraries because of increased HTTP requests and bandwidth load? Are responsive images and just hand-coding our projects worth doing to ensure lighter weight pages? I know it's not going to happen, but just wanted to ask your opinion. You have a great show here. Keep it up. Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel like we should do that thing. The average page weight has increased 30% to an average of 1.25 megabytes. Tim, we need a real live soundbite from the man himself.
Dang.
I'd like to start off by saying that, you know, calling web pages fat is just offensive.
We need to be more sensitive about that issue. I agree. Yeah.
I brought it up because, you know, so you're freelance, Tim. You make sites all the time. How much time do you spend thinking about performance, and like, do you go in and weigh the page when you're done and be like, oh, that's too much. I should make decisions on how to get it smaller and stuff like that. Is that part of your workflow?
I think it has been. I've had to pay more attention to it because before I didn't care, and that wasn't the right way of going about things. And especially because, I mean, now, like, I think Luke Rubluski, in one of his talks, he said that like 85% of the web is accessed through a mobile phone, which is an astounding number. And it's like, you know, you have to pay attention to load times if tons of your visitors are coming from a mobile device, because they're, you know, their speeds aren't as good. And so, yeah, what I've tried to do is like do image compression and things like that, from a design perspective. But in terms of like using tons of libraries, I don't usually do that. So that's not one of my problems. And, actually Dave has a really good post on performance and WordPress, which I reference a lot. So
thanks. Thank you. Yeah, no, I think performance is a big deal. It's been getting like, you know, I feel like with responsive even coming out, and now we're trying to do more, you know, with the JavaScript and all that, or in just the CSS and the assets and everything, sites are indeed getting fatter. But I think that would be a trend even without responsive. But man, performance, like optimizing performance is so important, man. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, it's the biggest thing. It's so huge.
And it used to be like we lived under a kilobyte limit, you know, like somebody was like, your website cannot be more than, you know, 200 kilobytes.
Yeah, 200K was big for a while. A lot of people were even 100.
Yeah, well, and that's where the 10K apart started. It was just like, remember when you like could make a website with 10K, you know? Dang, there you go.
Right. Right. It's a big deal. 1.25 megabytes, that's 6 times bigger than that small target. I don't think that's that bad these days, although I don't know. I don't know. Like, I guess it depends on the site, it depends on the traffic, it depends on some stuff. I don't know. I feel like that's probably about the size of CFS's tricks at the moment, so I'm not sure if I'm trying to rationalize
myself. Yeah. That's good. Keep going with it.
But that is a little fat. What concerns me more is the trend than the size, and that if we're going to increase 30% every year, I almost guarantee that's faster. That's a bigger rate of growth than bandwidth speed is increasing worldwide. Yeah. Yeah. So that's not good. We got to take that into consideration.
I feel like your page can be 1.25 megabytes, okay? Like, it's large. It's, like, larger than, like, floppy disks were back in the day. I mean, like, it's ginormous. And, you know, and if you're, like, trying to download that on the Edge network, that is just awful. But, like, if you can justify every kilobyte and you put thought into it, that's good job. You know, like, if you ran it through PageSpeed and you've taken the time to be like, oh, you know what? I did this today. Like, we're about to launch a client site. And, you know, there's these, like, big pages with these big graphics. And I was just like, oh, I'm just going to see how these are, like, kind of sorting out and page speeding. And it was like, oh, did you know if you optimize these, losslessly optimize these, you'd save 89 kilobytes. And that's, like, a fourth of the page, you know, it would bring it down to like 300K. And I'm just like, well, shoot, you know, I thought it was fine, but then I checked it and now it's like, oh, I could probably make this like 25% faster. So
yeah, that's a big number.
I've always wondered, Chris, how the heck your site is so fast considering that there's so much stuff on it.
On CSSTricks.com?
Yeah. Like, what do you do to make it so fast?
Well, there's a couple of things, you know, like the number of requests isn't that high. You know, there's some pretty simple rules. I feel like, for one thing, there's only like one or two JavaScript and CSS files on any given page. So the number of requests is fairly low. It's not super, super, super crazy low, but I keep an eye on that thing. That's a big deal. It's just straight up the number of requests. There's very few images. If you just load the homepage of CSS Tricks, there's like three-ish. And a lot of the other stuff is like icon fonts, an SVG, so that kind of, you know, which is an image, I guess, but it loads so quick and it's so compressed, I barely even think of SVG as images. And a lot of it is just CSS, you know, doing the job. The other thing is that it's on a CDN, so I, you know, literally use a CDN to serve the assets from, which that's a big deal. And it's cached really well. So it's on WordPress and it uses W3 Total Cache. And not only does it use that plugin, but as Dave can attest to too, I literally had the guy who wrote it, Frederick Towns, come in and like fine tune the server that CSS Tricks is on and fine tune his plugin to work with it. So he got all the right settings and all that stuff. So it's kind of it just became a big deal because CSS Tricks would go down occasionally and I had some performance problems and it came down to the point where I really need somebody to come in and do that. And, you know, they just did it for Dave and the server that Chop Talk Show is on. So that's right. Is it?
Yeah. No, they came through and, we hired them to fix up our server because we are having problems. You guys might remember if you went to Shop Talk Live, it would just fall over and turn white pages and everything like that. It was just, and I'm at the point, I do so much front end stuff. I'm not on the server much. So, you know, hiring somebody to tune my server was awesome. I don't know. I often liken it to guitar playing. I don't know if you guys play guitar. I know Chris does, but like, I can tune a guitar. I can, you know, bing, bling, you know, I can tune a guitar, but I'm not a luthier. And a luthier is somebody who, like, knows how to make the intonation of each fret on the guitar the correct intonation that is, like, at the 44,000 megahertz limit, you know?
Wow, really stretching this metaphor.
I'm going deep here. but... That's it. That's it's these people, there's experts in this, and it's such an important part of your performance. You should probably learn how to do that or hire somebody to do that.
Especially if it's literally a problem. I have a talk about performance where there's the performance golden rule, right? Which is generally a thing that's credited to Steve Souders, who's a web performance dude. And it's that 80% of the time that it takes a website to load, if you look at the whole timeline, 20% of it is the server response, and 80% of it is the browser doing stuff with what it got from the server. So like finding images and parsing through your CSS and downloading additional assets that the response told it to go get and all that type of stuff. So if that 20% is serving a white page, you got a big problem and you got to fix that. But in general, most of the time that you should spend optimizing is on the 80%. You should spend 80% of your time fixing that 80%, essentially. So things like making sure all your assets are compressed and that you're serving, you're gzipping all those assets, and you're optimizing images like Tim mentioned, and you're, I don't know, all these little things, compressing them together. In the question Don Ricardo asked, and does that mean we should not use frameworks and libraries and stuff? No, CSS Tricks uses jQuery. I don't use it for that much, but I use it for enough that it really is worth being there. I don't think that just the fact that jQuery is loading on CSS Tricks is bloaty. In fact, I'm quite sure that it's not. It would be bloaty if I didn't have this 1-2-3 rule. If I was like, the CSS Tricks uses jQuery and it uses Prism.js for code highlighting and it uses the slider plugin and it uses this and this and this. And if I loaded them all up individually, that would be dumb. Yeah. That would, and then people would look at that and be like, oh, those frameworks we're using bloat your site. And that's the conclusion that they would come to, but that's not necessarily the case. It's how I'm using them that's bloating it. What I should do is have use a pre-processed, some kind of server client, or I'm sorry, like local dev side thing to compress all that stuff together. And that's exactly what I do. So all those plugins and frameworks and stuff I get used get all combined and squished together into a global file. That's what gets served, and so it's anyway, it's just part of combining and compressing. This is a good. I have some slides up. If you go to csstricks.com right now and go to the second most recent blog post says slides from recent presentations. I have one of these. I'm not like a web performance super expert, but I have this talk I do on making websites faster. That's just simple stuff that even people like me can do to make very big difference of web performance. So it's in that blog post is a set of slides that you can kind of jump through that cover all these things that I'm talking about.
You did a screencast on that too, right?
Yes.
Let's do a bunch of simple stuff to make websites faster.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. Yes, that's that slideshow only spoken, which would be even better to watch.
Okay. I was going to just, for nerdy JavaScript people, there is like this old post that talked about JavaScript functions and properties that cause a reflow or a repaint or a lay. It triggers the layout to change. I found one, but I think it would be interesting to look at this and maybe, I don't know, like go through the jQuery functions and say like all of these trigger layout, so be careful or just know that, or maybe there's some sort of linter or something that could be built that's like this. You have 42 functions that trigger layout, in one method. So maybe don't do that. I think that would be kind of neat.
Well, definitely, like for example, you guys, if you were to write like a bit of JavaScript that said window.load function. So you're waiting for the window to load. And then I'm just paraphrasing jQuery here. And then like target the body and say CSS padding 10 pixels or something. That would be kind of stupid because it would like wait for the whole page to be done. Then it would grab the body and add some padding to it, which the body wraps everything. So it has to push everything in a little bit. It'll cause a repaint on the entire screen. Mm. So it would be like slow. It would be that's kind of what you're talking about,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
And people do inadvertently do stuff like that all the time. It may not be that you add a padding to the body, but it may be that you inject some little bit of something in such a place on your page that it's causing this repaint and stuff.
Yeah.
Cool. Cool.
Let's just do the next one. I feel like that's good.
Yeah, here we go. From Ryan Boone, he's writing in, and this is kind of fancy here. So, I'm working on a website for a dental practice, and the client wants patients to be able to fill out medical forms online prior to their appointments. I've been researching this and considering the HIPAA or HIPAA web requirements. It seems completely over my head. I'm a novice at best with PHP, and I've never worked with SSL. My questions are, one, is there a plug-and-play HIPAA-compliant WordPress plugin to do this safely? And two, should I go with a hosting company that's been HIPAA-certified compliant, or is that just a marketing ploy to generate unnecessary niche in the market? Okay, that's question one, right? We'll take a break here.
Is there two?
That was two questions. So is there a plug-and-play WordPress plugin? And then should he go with the hosting company that's HIPAA compliant?
I kind of put this in here I'm sure, Tim, you're not like a HIPAA compliance expert. I don't think any of us are. But I'm just curious if when you do like freelance work, if like does that stuff kind of come up for you once in a while that's like some ask about some crazy thing and you're just like, ugh. You know, like, how do you even, like, approach something like this? If somebody's like, okay, I want to make your website HIPAA compliant, where do you even start?
I have never had a client talk to me about HIPAA compliant stuff. And even if they did, honestly, at that point, I'm like, let's talk to the other developer that knows more than me.
So, sure, you just kind of ask other people that you work with.
Yep.
Yeah. So HIPAA, I think, is specifically for medical stuff, but there's not just HIPAA compliance. There's also like, you know, the accessibility one or whatever. Dave mm-hmm. probably knows that one.
WCAG, ARIA.
So we can talk specifically about HIPAA, but I just thought I would open up the question a little wider and you know, be like, what do we do when clients kind of ask for these things that are clearly very important to them that we don't know anything about? So we'll get onto that in a second, but just because I worked at Wufoo for a number of years there, Wufoo makes forms, right? And a lot of HIPAA compliance is if you're asking for information on a form, what are you like doing with that information? And that better be super wicked secure because it needs to, you know, be compliant with this thing for, you know, for security reasons and privacy reasons and all that stuff. You can't have a hospital website and just code up your own form asking for people's like, do you have warts on your butt? And yes or no? And then have that send over the wave over HTTP, you know, like that breaks some laws and stuff.
Yeah.
So
dang.
People would, they want to have a form and they want it to be HIPAA compliant. So why not use something like Wufoo? Can't we just make Wufoo HIPAA compliant and then they're all good? And we used to, people would ask this type of thing all the time. And we had an auto expander, like when we had to do support, and it would just be like .HIPAA, and then text expander would like write the email for us. This is how we did like 80% of support. And it said this. I'll read
trade
it out
secrets
loud.
Right there.
Yeah, totally. it said, "Hi there. We do not actively maintain HIPAA compliance. While we do meet their security requirements, there are a bunch of documentation level requirements that we do not provide. Items such as publicly accessible risk assessment information, compliance documents, and having a security evangelist on staff. These are not things we participate in. If you're planning on collecting medical information through Wufoo, I would recommend against that. However, if you're just using Wufoo for contact forms and surveys, collecting non-medical data, that we would be great. The bona fide plan offers SSL and encrypted fields in it." So nobody can help you. There might be human beings that aren't helping, but there's no such thing as a WordPress plugin that's HIPAA compliant because it doesn't do enough. It can be secure, but even a WordPress plugin can't do it because you have to, it certainly has to be SSL. You certainly have to do certain things with your data things that just transcend the ability of WooFoo or any CMS to be entirely HIPAA compliant. There's all this other stuff you have to do to be HIPAA compliant that is beyond just tech choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just know that. Ryan Boone, who's asking this question. It's more than tech. It's a whole world.
Somebody in the chat room is saying you should get hosting that is HIPAA compliant, because if you don't and something happens, like you're in the hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines territory. So yeah. I imagine your dentist office would rather just pay an extra $50 a month for hosting rather than paying, like, you know, federal penalties about information leaks. And it's a huge breach of trust for your clients if, like, you have to send them an email that says, like, we just leaked all your medical data, so sorry about that.
Yeah.
Come back.
Yeah.
That's tough. That's, like, I think that's, like, extreme hosting is, again, it's, unless you're an expert, I would hire somebody who is, you know.
Well, it sounds like you have to if you want to be HIPAA compliant. That's one of the rules.
Yeah. Yeah.
Either that or tell them you're going to have to do it the old-fashioned way and collect their information in person.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
No shame. Well, I mean, if you don't do it wrong, you know.
Yeah.
My wife actually works at a skincare clinic just down the street. And like, I'm always like, oh, wouldn't it be easier if I just made you a web form? And then she's just like, yeah, but then like, no, like, cause it's just, you know, I want to stop filling out forms every time I go to a doctor's office, but like that, it's just, you need a printed record as a doctor. You need like a, you know, stuff like that. So there's, it's just easier for everyone to do it manually, which is sucks, but that's where it's at right now. So,
yeah.
Thanks, Obama.
Thanks, Opera.
Thanks, Opera.
All right. All right, everybody. Go to 2013.incontrolconference.com. They're selling early bird tickets to the conference in Orlando, Florida, February 17th through 19th. I went 2 years ago, maybe, just as an attendee, just to go check out In Control in Orlando. And I was like, floored. It's such a good conference. They put on a good show, great speakers. They have this kind of interesting thing where the slots are like a little over an hour each. So the speakers really get a long time to kind of spread their wings and make a long kind of presentation. I kind of like the quick hits ones too in general, but I appreciate that In Control is different in that way. It's kind of a 2 day thing, or history. It's probably workshops, right? Oh gosh, I'm terrible. I think anyway,
it's going to be like workshops, and then there's
and then
be
2 days.
Speaking.
I was going to say that, but I didn't see. Maybe the workshops aren't scheduled yet, but the speakers are. Speakers including me. Speakers including Dave.
Hey-o.
Yeah. Let's see. Some of our old friends that were at the other In Control that we were just at. So Gillenwater is going to be there. Dave McFarlane. Samantha Warren from Twitter is going to be there. Carl Smith. Oh, he's the keynote. Oh, whatever. Fancy Carl gets to be the keynote again.
Megan Fisher is going to be there. She's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. From New York. Josh Clark and Ben Callahan, who we get to hang out with in Hawaii. Lots of people are going to be there. It's going to be awesome. It's, you know, it's at one of my favorite at conferences where the hotel is the venue too. So if you're tired, you can kind of just go back up to your room or whatever. You don't have to like catch a cab back to your old place or whatever. So anyway, I like it. It's a good venue. They treat people well. The speakers are good. The conference is good. I can't wait to go again. And they're selling early bird tickets now for $7.99. And you can change. And you, if you use coupon code Shop Talk Show, it's good for another $100 off of that. So,
mm-hmm. Dang. There is an authentic one. Yes. I love it.
All right. Let's do. Can we fit in two more? I think we can. Let's do the James Bate asks, I'm making a responsive website for a client. The website has a print icon in the side panel. The client asked me to remove the print icon on the mobile version. However, isn't this just making assumptions about how users will interact with the site? No printing on mobile. If I remove it from the mobile breakpoint, shouldn't I just omit it entirely? What are your thoughts? So James wants to remove this button, and he's just thinking that feels weird because It's just, it's, you know, different content for different devices. I heard that's a no-no kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts, Tim?
I don't know. I think that, like, general rule should be on a case-by-case basis because, I don't know, do people print from their mobile phone? I mean, unless you use AirPrint, right?
Yeah, but, like, it's not real common.
Yeah.
And I doubt there's a web-based API for it. You know what I mean?
If you hit, like, the JavaScript print function, do you get sent to your printer from your phone?
I don't know. We should try it, sure. I guess.
I'll work on it. You guys keep talking.
Okay. This is the kind of thing where I'm like, no, it doesn't work. It's impossible. You can't do it. And then immediately we get an email of somebody who's like, oh, dude, if you just do window.print, it brings up the, you know. Anyway, I think that's weird. I would assume that the removing a print button makes a lot of sense on mobile. I've never seen a mobile website in my life that had a... that was missing a print button or that had a print button on it. That just seems bizarre.
Yeah, I agree.
But what kind of website is it, James? Now I'm telling you stuff and I feel like maybe the point of this website is like a coloring book and the whole point of it is to print it out, you know, or something. And then you should probably keep trying and figure out how you can get this thing.
Yeah,
printing on mobile.
Well, my other question would be because on iOS you have the AirPrint, right? But on Android, is there any way you can print from an Android device?
Well, it doesn't look like it. And Connor in the chat room says that doesn't work on Android. But does that mean that it does work on iOS? I kind of doubt it, you know. But I wouldn't put it past Apple to detect whether you have AirPrint installed or not, and then all of a sudden it hijacks window.print and opens AirPrint. Like that seems reasonable that it would do that.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
This thing falls into, like, is this a system-level function, you know, printing, liking, tweeting, Facebooking? Like, you can do all that stuff on the system level now. So do you need to have these buttons on mobile or even anything? So... I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Next.
Next. All right, cool.
No, let's do the last one.
All right, cool. Let's do it. This one from Eduardo? Yes, this is directly for Mr. Tim Smith. Could you ask Tim what his secret technique is to keep things rolling? I love what I do, but sometimes the motivation isn't there, and I have to use a deadline as the driving force of a project. Tim, how do you keep things rolling? Because you do a lot, man. You always seem to have like a side project cooking in addition to your podcast. So how do you do all that?
I think what it is trying to keep your commitments to things that you like doing. I think you're right. I do a lot, but I try to start things that I know I have a passion for. And yes, I keep myself to deadlines, you know, like Make Awesome Magazine, that has to be out April, like come hell or high water. So, you know, that pushes me to do it. Not to mention that, you know, people know about it, so they're going to keep pestering me if I don't do it. but I think that's what it is. It's choosing to do things that you really like doing, and keeping yourself organized. I mean, I keep a cheddar list of all the things that I need to get done for a specific project. And I try to mark them off as quickly and as organized as possible. So that's how I keep things rolling. I try to stay organized.
That's awesome. So
I like the social accountability thing that you mentioned, where like people will pester me if I don't do it. Yeah. So like let the world know that you're doing it, and then you have some accountability for doing it.
Was it difficult? So we didn't really talk about it because maybe it's a sore point for you. But so Mick Awesome, you had the Kickstarter, right?
Yeah.
And then it unfortunately did not fund, but you're still doing it. So was it tough to find motivation maybe after like not making the funding? Was that kind of difficult?
No, because I realized that the magazine didn't fund because people didn't like the idea. The magazine didn't fund because it was my fault. So that distinction kind of helps me to continue going with it because people really like the idea. It's just that I was dumb about how I did the Kickstarter. I priced the magazine too high. The funding point was too high as well. So what I'm trying to do now is, you know, I've been researching printers and I actually got a quote here locally in Minneapolis that is going to print the magazine for like $2,000 less, than, nice. Than the original estimate that I got. So that's a huge thing because that helps me be able to sell the magazine for less because really I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to make $1 million with the magazine. I just want people to read it and hopefully find it useful. So, you know, I think that was the difference. It didn't affect me because it wasn't that people didn't like it because there was tons of support and I appreciate everybody that, you know, that backed the project. It was just a matter of me never doing a Kickstarter project and not really doing my due diligence in terms of research and that's why it failed. So it was more my fault.
But you're back up and you're motivated. So
right now I'm talking to a couple of companies that are really interested in sponsoring the magazine. So they're going to help pay for printing basically. So that's a huge thing because we're planning on releasing the magazine come April. So
I think it's a big win for companies that sponsor magazines. Like you're sponsoring something that goes into somebody's house forever.
Exactly.
You're printing, you know, like it's kind of a big deal. It's kind of like when I went to CVS yesterday to get some whatever, some stuff. And they're like, do you have a CVS card? I'm like, no. And they're like, oh, here's a pile of them. Put them all in all their stuff. And you're like, you know, I'm like, yeah, I'm sure you want me to attach it to my backpack and keychain and wallet and forehead. You know, like it's just free advertising for them, you know, and that's kind of the idea with print stuff, too, is that it's just long lasting advertising. That's why you should sponsor podcasts, too, because these things kind of just stick around forever. It's not like buying a monthly ad on the web that is when that month is gone, it's gone. There's no record of it. That advertising is gone forever. It's surprising to me kind of that companies are more willing to sponsor transient stuff like a web ad than they are permanent stuff.
And what I love about podcast sponsorships is, especially for my show, and I know you guys do this too, is that you only let companies that you really like sponsor the show. You know, I'm not out to, you know, again, make tons of money with the sponsorship. So I can say no. And it's great because then you get to talk about products and companies that you actually care about and that you think that you would recommend to a friend. So that's what I try to do. And it's nice for the company because then they get, you know, a very personal experience out of it.
Absolutely.
Agreed.
Speaking of putting things on your body.
Go on. I'm not going to stop.
I don't know why. I don't know why I didn't mention this at the top of the show, but it's kind of a big day. If you go to shoptalkshow.com/store, we have Shop Talk t-shirts now.
Ta-da!
As of this morning. This
I thing saw is ready that. To go.
Yeah, so this is brand new. Shop Talk Show, people in the chat room, you're our best customers. Did I tell you how much I like all you chat room people? Who's going to be the first one? Not one person has ordered a shirt yet. So I'd like to see that happen. Anyway, that's new. I'll probably bug you about it next week because I think we lose people at the way end of the show, you know. So I'll mention it at the top of the show next time, and I'll probably bug you about it in a few other places. But yeah, there's shirts. And I want to mention, so the shirt, even the picture on the right, that is what the shirt looks like. It's a little darker than that. And because it's a little darker, you can see the Shop Talk Show a little fainter. It's printed by a great place in Florida called Real Thread that does this water-based injection printing. So it's not this big glop of ink on your shirt. It's kind of it's more subtle and into the shirt than that. It's really nice, I think. But fair warning, the design is very subtle on the shirt, like really subtle, like more subtle than that photo is. I should probably change it. So it kind of looks like a shirt you've had forever, kind of, that's just been kind of washed out or whatever. I think it looks kind of awesome, especially since we have this kind of like car garage look going on Shop Talk. It looks kind of cool, but just saying, It's pretty subtle.
This is the same company that you got the CSS Tricks shirts with, right?
Yeah, and I just do it because they're a good printing company. I really like the style of printing. Like, people wear it. I go around, I feel like the friends and stuff I've given shirts to, I see them all the time actually wearing the shirt. And it's people that aren't trying to impress me, for sure. And I feel like they reach for the shirt because it's soft. It's a nice shirt. The design on it isn't this big, inky, gloppy thing, which you have those, too, from, like, cheap, you know, I don't know. Well, not all cheap, but you know what I mean. Like, you have some shirts like that laying around, and you just don't grab for them because they're just not comfortable. They're not this, like, I love it, snuggly, soft thing.
It's a comfy shirt. I mean, I use the CSS Trick shirt as one of my pajama shirts.
All right. So there's shirts for Shop Talk Show. Oh, somebody bought one. Who? Oh, Tim Smith. You dirty.
Dirty dog.
Tim won the contest.
Winner. Well, cool. Speaking of giving people money, Tim, how can people give you money and follow you on Twitter and do all that stuff?
Well, I am I'm Timothy B. Smith on Twitter. You can find me at timothybsmith.com. And to give me money, huh, that's a good one. I need to figure that one out. I guess you could hire me for your next project, and you can look at my work on my personal site. So,
and you've got a magazine coming out in April that everyone needs to buy.
Yes, you can find that at Make Awesome, which is Make Awesome and then .me. And sign up for the newsletter because we're actually renaming the magazine. And that's going to be happening in the next couple of days. So,
cool, very cool. Looking forward to it.
Smith.com, very nice, clean design style, lovely blog.
Thank you.
Thanks for being on. What's the follow? What's the final thing?
Yeah, I was just going to say thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to everyone for coming out in the chat room. You guys always keep us factual. We really appreciate that. Rate us up in iTunes, 5 stars. It's that easy. And follow us on Shop Talk, at Shop Talk Show on Twitter. And of course, go to the brand new shoptalkshow.com/store and purchase a brand new t-shirt. Yeah. Chris.
ChopTalkShow.com.